Also, that in 1960 you were a page at the Democratic National Convention, and in that period you were also subscribing to the Student Voice, which was the newsletter of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. So I feel the 60s coming on in your own personal experience there. But there was one contrasting experience, it seems contrasting to me, and that was that you were enrolled in an ROTC training program between 59 and 61. How did those all fit together, and what was bubbling up in you at that time?
That's a nice question. It certainly can sound odd to people. It was not out of any personal enthusiasm that I enrolled in ROTC. It was a requirement of all people who weren't military veterans, females, or conscientious objectors, which I had no idea what that meant. To any extent that I thought of it, I thought it was restricted to a couple of religious sects. I was 16 years old when starting UCLA, and I fit the requirements, so I figured that's the way I had to do it. Now, a friend of mine purposely did not go to a University of California campus, although he had the choice for those first couple of years of his college schooling, because he wanted to stay away from that. So there were people who had more consciousness than I about it back then. So that was my enrollment, and I figured, on the advice of somebody who was already a student, that in the Air Force ROTC, you wouldn't carry a rifle around. So I thought that'd be interesting, learn about flight, things like that. Then, however, the peace subjects did come up, and you could have identified me as trouble back then, not because I was, any bad behavior in the class. I got all the highest grades and everything, but that just seemed to be a habit of mine. But I remember one day the instructor, whom I liked quite a bit, a charming young man, wrote our national objectives on the blackboard. And he had, number one is to possess sufficient destructive power to be able to harm or destroy any potential attacker. Number two was to have communicated to the other party, have that known. And number three was let the other party know under what circumstances we, always meaning, of course, the United States and its military, would employ the destructive power, so they'd know what were the things that they could and couldn't do without suffering the retaliation. And then number four was create an atmosphere for peace. And I looked over the list and I asked the lieutenant, because something seemed wrong to me. Not that I rejected the deterrence kind of thinking. I didn't. But I didn't think that as long as you were in that deterrence posture, you'd be able to create an atmosphere for peace. It just didn't add up. Be so prepared under the right, or we should say wrong, conditions to use all that destructive power on some party somewhere in the world, that just didn't seem to be the spirit from which you could build peace. And so I asked him about what appeared to be this contradiction. He simply repeated the objectives and didn't see any difficulty at all. And I remember outside of class, I went through this again with him because what was he not understanding about my doubts, and what was I not understanding about his comfort with this? I remember holding my bicycle and standing outside, and he was, as I say, a very genial guy and quite willing to go over it again and help this puzzled student. But we didn't resolve our different understandings there, and I haven't got that straight yet in my mind about how a hostile posture ready to wreak great destruction could allow enough room in our mind and spirit for the creativity and inventiveness and even some risk-taking that would be required to improve a conflict atmosphere, to use a more general term than to build peace. It impressed me quite a lot. That incident impressed me quite a lot. And it's actually, as I look back, formed one of the bases of my interest in psychology and trauma and how it affects people's thinking and choices right through today, including some of my professional work.